Guys, gals, non-binary pals, different circles is moving. Same day, different time slot. We're now on Fridays at 9 p.m. Join me from 9 to 10 p.m. for an adventure through sound. Who knows, you might just find your next favorite song.
This February, find where live art meets extended reality. Single Thread Theater presents PXR 2026, a mix of live performances, interactive digital presentations, technical deep dives, and exciting installations right here in Kingston at Modern Fuel, The Tet, and at Fort Henry. Get whisked away into immersive worlds like snowy cities, cyberpunk dystopias, musical mushrooms, and coastal shores. The conference runs February 20th through March 1st. Learn more by following Single Thread Theater on Instagram and get your tickets now via performanceandxr.com. See you there.
Welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, and CFRC. So a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It's a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. And today, I would like to introduce you to Anna Smythe, who's doing an MA in Classics and Archaeology under the supervision of Dr. Jean-Mathieu Carbon and Dr. Barbara Reeves. Welcome to Grad Chat, Anna.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for coming, especially on a chilly morning like this.
Not cold to my standards.
Okay.
I appreciate it nonetheless.
And your research topic looks at two case studies in ancient Greek everyday writing, potentially written by subordinate people. Can you tell us a little bit more about your topic and give us a bit of an overview of your topic?
For sure. So what I mean by everyday writing is basically I'm trying to look at mediums that are a bit more accessible. Mm. So everyday writing examples can be things like letters or graffiti or curse tablets, which don't sound immediately accessible, but they're a lot more common than you would think in ancient Greece and Rome. It's anything like that anyone could have written, right? Because if they had the literacy to do so, they would have the accessibility to the materials and, in theory, the knowledge of how to format that specific piece of writing because they were decently widespread. Mm. So my two case studies are the collection of Attic herders' graffiti that was found by Dr. Merle Langdon. They're, if you go to visit them today, they're on the outskirts of Athens in a very empty kind of outside of suburbia area on a bunch of hills that are terrible to navigate because of the prickly oak. And they date to approximately the Archaic period, which is just before the Classical period. So we're looking at the 7th and 6th centuries BCE, approximately. And I'm also looking at the Dodona oracular tablets. These are inscriptions written on little lead tablets in Greek. They date from approximately the 6th to the 2nd centuries BCE, so a very wide range. And there's thousands of them.
Wow.
I know, it's crazy.
That's a lot for a classic scholar.
Yeah, I'm not looking at all of them. I have, sorry, I'm getting loud. I have a selection of them. I'm looking at about 16 of them in total. But within those tablets, there are inscriptions potentially written by subordinate people, which we don't find very often. Mm-hmm. And the Attic herders' graffiti are so named because they're rock-cut graffiti. Mm. Potentially written by herders. And identifying who's written both of these is difficult and can never be certain.
Of course, yes.
But there are indications in both that suggest they were written by subordinate people, herders specifically for the graffiti. Mm-hmm. And specifically within the tablets I'm looking at to compare as much as I can to the Attic Herders graffiti, mm-hmm. ones potentially written by herders. Mm. And I'm also looking at ones potentially written by enslaved people because there is so little that we have that survived written by enslaved people in ancient Greece. And this was a phenomenal opportunity to be able to examine a group of them from the same context. Mm-hmm. And of course, that spans a couple decades, and the ones I'm looking at go from approximately the 6th to the 4th centuries BCE, but you don't normally find them grouped together. And so that was my thorough path into being able to try and study potentially direct voices from the past of subordinate people.
Wow, that sounds really exciting because, like you said, there's so few things, and even in more modern circumstances, there's so few things from subordinate people. Mm-hmm. So that's very exciting that you've identified two different areas that you can research on, two different groups of people that span this period, and to give you some comparison and to pull out some big themes. So how are you analyzing these collections?
So I'm doing it in kind of a piecemeal way, if that makes sense. Any kind of analysis of anything that's potentially written by subordinate people warrants a lot of caution because our record, the classical record, is predominantly written by wealthy male slaveholders. Mm-hmm. So especially in the case of enslaved people, we have to be very, very, very careful that we don't, if there are primary voices in front of us, muddle that with modern interpretation. Mm. And of course, that applies as well to herders and to other folks of lower socioeconomic status. But keeping that in mind, I'm examining the text that survives, which can be difficult because these especially in the case of the lead tablets, the Dodona tablets, a lot of them have been folded, and so they've been unfolded to examine them, resulting in cracks, and sometimes the writing has smudged or been pressed down so it's very faint, and sometimes there's chunks of a tablet missing, and we don't know how much is missing because it breaks off at what we have now as an edge.
Of course.
And the same happens with the graffiti in that they've been exposed to the elements for centuries. Yeah. So they can be quite hard to read because they're so faint now and hard to find. Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking at what survives of the text to try and figure out, okay, what's the purpose of this text? Why did the author write this? Was it actually written by an enslaved person or a herder? How can we tell that? How can we argue this? How certain is that argument? Mm. And then I'll be looking at things like, are there any connections in what they're talking about? Mm. So are they talking about wanting freedom? Are they talking about cows? There's an assortment of topics that we find in the tablets. And I'm also examining the tablets and the graffiti through a paleographic lens, which is the study of ancient writing. This is where my research is somewhat innovative to my knowledge, at least, no one has tried to examine sources from subordinate people via their paleography. So I'd be looking at things like handwriting, errors in the text, like spelling errors, grammatical errors, and in general, how the text is aligned on the tablet. And I'm doing so to see if I can identify any sociolinguistic indicators of status. Mm-hmm. My current theory is that I will not be able to. And so far, I have not been able to, which is phenomenal because then I get to say, we all can assume that this group of people is diverse. Mm-hmm. And here's I can accurately say that yes, at least in the ones that I'm looking at, they are diverse in their literacy, in how they pen their tablets, in how they inscribe graffiti, so on and so forth.
Oh, that's really interesting. So it sounds like you're doing a lot in this project, in many different things, many approaches, lots of different sources in the selections you've made. And it sounds like you're making quite an intervention as well and looking at some different things. So why is epigraphy or this everyday writing so important to the study of subordinate people in antiquity and especially pre-Hellenistic Greece? And I think you've touched on this a little bit, but what what does it do for the field and for us and in general?
For sure. I have touched on it a little bit, but I always love to expand upon
yes,
it
of
because
course, no.
More people should study epigraphy. Maybe I'm biased on that, but epigraphy is one of the fields in classics that's continually revealing new information about the ancient world. It's hard to do that in our literary sources. A lot of our literary works survive in papyrus, which predominantly comes from Egypt, and normally does not date before the Hellenistic period. I don't know of a single instance of papyrus from before the Hellenistic period. And so when you're trying to learn about ancient Greece or Rome before, you know, 323 BCE, it's difficult if you're looking only through written word, not through epigraphy. Epigraphy is the exception to that because it survives, not amazingly, but it does survive sometimes on less perishable material like lead or rock. Also, you can find it on pottery as well, though the lines blur between disciplines at that point. It might actually be papyrology at that point, because if it's painted on a potsherd, is that not like painting on papyrus? I think the distinctions don't matter personally in that case, but that's where it gets a bit blurry. So looking at epigraphy can reveal sources of information and information in general that we don't have through the literary record or even through the archaeological record. The literary record has the benefit of being more informative more easily because we can look at the words and be like, okay, it says this. There's, of course, nuance in what are the biases of the author? Does this word mean which of 17 definitions that it could be in this context? Are there dialect stuff that we have to look out for? But it's hard to do that kind of interpretation in archaeology, for example, because you don't have written explanations of what's going on. So if you find a group of loom weights in a room in what you think is a house, for example, can you say, okay, I think this room was specifically used to weave? It's possible, but hard to argue. It could be that the person who owned this house just felt like throwing their loom weights out in this room.
Yeah, just like we do, right? You just throw your gym bag in the corner for storage. Maybe you throw loom weights in, in the corner for storage too until you go back to weaving.
Exactly. So it's hard to interpret anything. Well, you have to do it by comparing material, of course. And that's when you bring in the literary record when you're analyzing stuff archaeologically to support your analysis and try and fill the holes in the information in front of you. And epigraphy is a nice middle ground between the two, where you have a material source that has come from likely an archaeological context, but it also has writing on it. And so, for example, you can use inscriptions to identify the owners of a house at one point in time. It might say, like, you know, Julia and Philip, and then give a date under perhaps a statue that was in the house or maybe above a threshold somewhere. And you can then say, okay, very likely Julia and Philip owned or at least lived in this house from this point to this point. Great. Beautiful. So epigraphy can help contextualize finds from archaeology and from our literary sources. And both archaeology and our literary sources are almost bereft of direct voices from subordinate people. You can use the literary record to gain some information about maybe what it would have been like to live as a subordinate person in ancient Greece. But it's very, very difficult because more often than not, our authors are the elite people that are oppressing these subordinate people. And so we have to be very careful. So especially when doing subordinate studies in classics, epigraphy is very important as one of the few potential windows in directly into the lived experience of subordinate people.
And where does subordinate studies in the field of classics and archaeology currently fit? Like, what's the significance of it in the field?
So classics and archaeology is a field with a very colonialist history. It started with Europeans believing that Rome and Greece were the ideal societies and that they, as imperial powers, should emulate Rome and Greece in their heydays, I'm using air quotes here, of their imperial powers. Mm. So especially they'd look at Athens' empire or Rome's empire to justify and model themselves after those imperialist tendencies and conquerings. Mm-hmm. So at the beginning, the field focused almost entirely on the literary aspect of Greece and of Rome, and it was not great, in my opinion, at least. So now in the modern day, because classics, Greece and Rome, are so influential in popular culture still. Mm-hmm. For example, we had the Gladiator movie, the sequel, come out recently. Mm-hmm. There's an Odyssey movie coming up very, very soon. It still pervades modern thought. And some of the biases from Greece and from Rome, and also from how our field started, still pervade. So the especially thought of like West versus East in Greece's wars against Persia to justify Western ideas of democracy versus Islam, especially. Islamophobia is rampant in our field's past. And so studying subordinate studies now is a way to advance the field, to learn more about antiquity, to help us better understand how we got to where we are as people who live in North America and more broadly the Western, with air quotes, world in general, by modeling ourselves off of these two countries. Mm-hmm. And it can help challenge our modern biases as well. And you can't do that without challenging Roman and Greek biases, these ancient ones, from the authors that have survived. And so subordinate studies is a way to do that and to learn more about especially the darker sides of Greece and of Rome, and to get a better, more well-rounded understanding of those countries' civilizations, and to get a better understanding of our own as well. So that's why I think it's important.
No, it sounds, it's incredibly important, right? You're getting this, like you so eloquently said, this fuller picture of the past, but also seeing those echoes in the present and understanding, you know, where the field has gone and how it follows kind of the flows and influences of the current day, and how you see those reflected back in the past and forward. So that's, I think, very important. Yeah. And you mentioned that you've got these two case studies, the Attic Herder's graffiti and the Dodona oracular tablets. Why did you choose these two case studies in particular?
So because I'm looking at my material through a paleographic lens, it involves a lot of comparison between the tablets and between the graffiti. So I can't accurately compare Herder's graffiti to Herder's tablets, at least with any certainty, because they are two different media in two different parts of Greece and it potentially centuries apart, depending on when my tablets are dating to. So I chose them because they had a large enough corpus size that I could do that internal comparison. So I'd be comparing the tablets potentially written by enslaved people with tablets potentially written by enslaved people to try and see if there was anything within that context that those tablets share that can indicate differences or similarities. So I needed to have a corpus size large enough to be able to do those comparisons without having very unreliable results. And these two source types, the Herder's graffiti and the Dodona oracular tablets, are like pretty well the only ones I could find in ancient Greek from ancient Greece that were large enough to fit my standards. Even then, they're not very large. And there's, of course, difficulties of identifying authors in both of them, especially for the tablets. I'm sure there are more tablets written by enslaved people that we simply cannot identify because there's no surviving indicators that they were enslaved. Maybe they're not talking about wanting to be free. Maybe they're asking a question about a trial that's coming up or about their home life. We wouldn't be able to know that they're enslaved. So the only tablets I can look at are the ones that either identify something about enslavement or, and this is where it gets a little bit more uncertain, contain the name of the person who is likely writing the tablet, and that name is attested elsewhere as most often or always in what we have that's survived belonging to an enslaved person. And it's the same with the Herders. Pretty well all of my tablets that are potentially written by Herders talk about animals. Cows, sheep, that kind of thing. And some of them talk about pasturage and things like that. But there are very likely more tablets that were written by herders that I just simply cannot identify. And for the herders' graffiti, they are identified as such because of the longer extant graffiti that we have. Sometimes the authors will identify themselves as herders. Oh, that's beautiful. It's probably unlikely that they're lying. That's not the simplest answer. So if we go Occam's razor, it's very likely that they were indeed herders. And also, there's nothing around that area. I've been there. There's nothing. So the water's nearby, and we're on a hill in the countryside, but there's no temples around. Mm. There's no architecture that's survived. It's just hills. So the prevailing theory is that, well, who would have reason to go to an area of just hills, and that's, well, potentially herders.
Yes. And then if they call themselves a herder, even better, right?
Exactly. Confirmed.
And so you mentioned you visit some of these places. So are your case study selections, are they, well, like the graffiti's in on site, but are your other, your Dodona oracular tablets, do you have to visit those in person as well? And what does that process look like?
Great question. So I needed to autopsy or to examine both of these sources in person because of my stipulation on paleography. I need to find the grittiness of the writing, or I will have no substance to my arguments. This is furthered in that both of them were only published in sketch form.
Okay.
So the archaeologists and the professors who first recorded and analyzed and published these pieces of writing didn't do so with photographs, which makes it harder to analyze the paleography, and especially in the case of the Dodona tablets, where there are over 4,000 inscriptions that these archaeologists had to go through, and quite frankly, some of them are really hard to read, as I learned when I was there. I wanted to go through with my own eyes to just see what the differences between the sketches published were versus when I was actually looking at the text. I'm also new to epigraphy, so I wanted the experience as well so that I could better understand the process of making sketches and be able to more critically analyze how sketches are made and how they're published so that I can go in with my own knowledge to make my assessments that way as well. So the herder's graffiti are indeed in situ. They're on site because they're on the ground.
Of course, yes.
And I was able to go there with the help of Dr. Stella Scalza, who was so kind in offering to take me in her car to this area. And we spent probably a good 4 to 6 hours romping around the attic countryside trying to find these graffiti. I had communicated with Merle Langdon, who very kindly gave me an approximate location for the two pieces of graffiti that I was going to look at. I didn't, unfortunately, have time or the resources to find more than that, as evidenced by how it took me 6 hours to find the second one. So I had an aerial photo, and I had a map, and then I had Google Maps open on my phone. And so we were walking around the hill being like, I think we're almost there. And we managed to find them. The sun had indeed set by the time we found the second one. But it's okay. We found them in the end. And so with her very, very gracious help and patience, we managed to find what we were looking for. And then for the tablets, they are currently housed in the Archaeological Museum of Yanina. And with the very gracious permission of the Greek Ministry of Culture and Sport and the effort of antiquities at Yanina, I was able to go to Yanina, which is in northern Greece, and examine these tablets firsthand. They're currently stored in the museum, the Archaeological Museum of Yanina. And so I was sat in their basement doing my best to examine tablets for the first time. This was before I did the graffiti. And so it was a lot of me looking at the lead tablets under a microscope going, oh God, why did three people write over each other on this tablet? And why didn't they think of me, the student 2,000 years in the future who's going to be trying to read this? I'm joking.
Of course, yeah.
It was tempting to think that way sometimes, but I, of course, stay impartial as an academic and managed to eventually read all of them as best that I could. So That was a very long-winded answer to your question.
No, no, but it's interesting, right, to see how people approach different sources. And these are very unique source types, again, of likely subordinate people and in two different places. And even though they're both in situ, held in very different contexts as well. You've got an outdoor site that you have to navigate. And then you have a museum site, which you also have to negotiate, right, to get access. So they're very different ways to access these two case studies that you're working on. So thank you for telling us about that. How do you keep notes on all of these things? Are you allowed to photograph anything? You mentioned sketches. Do you have time to make sketches of everything? What does that look like?
I've made sketches of all of the pieces that I've looked at. Mm. I'm currently in the process of editing the ones for the tablets in particular, because my idea with doing the sketches is to better define what I was seeing in the photographs, because quite frankly, even with my photographs, which I think turned out pretty well for the most part, it is still hard to read what's on those tablets. Mm. And the way they were published in the original corpus, the DVC is normally how it's abbreviated in 2013, is that the archaeologists that published these sketches did so where there was one sketch per inscription on the tablet. Mm. So for tablets that were palimpsests, so overwritten quite often, with maybe like 4 to 7 different inscriptions on them, they published 4 to 7 different sketches where they isolated that one inscription and then did the same for all the rest, which is phenomenal when you're trying to read the tablets, because
gives you a little bit of a roadmap to start from.
But as a result, those sketches were meant to elucidate the Greek on the tablet, and so they sometimes didn't contain the grittiness that I was looking for my particular studies. So I was like, okay, in that case, I'll sketch the tablet as it is. I'm not doing multiple sketches. Those already exist. I'll put them all over top of each other. Great. And I did that, and I did it all in the same color, and then I went, I can't read this. So now I'm going back through and I'm making the different inscriptions different colors so that you can distinguish them between each other while also still being able to tell what's going on. Because keeping them the same color lost the information of what inscription was more clearly defined, what was fainter because it was older and had been worn down a bit more, what was penned in a different way so this one looks sharper, maybe it was written with a point, whereas the other one looks a bit more blunt. That information was lost when I made that sketch, as I did initially. And for the graffiti, my sketches so far look very, very similar to what Dr. Merle Langdon has published. So the graffiti then has both survived a bit better than the Dodona tablets, which sometimes a piece has fallen off now, so you're missing a couple letters here and there. But at the same time, the graffiti is still hard to read, and very little of it has actually been published. So I did find some like personal names strewn around in the same context, in the same area as the graffiti that I was graffito that I was initially setting out to examine. So my sketches include whatever's around it in the proximity, just to say, in context, this is what's around.
Yeah.
Because when I'm examining graffiti, the benefit of it being in situ is I get to say, here's the context, and here's why I think this graffiti is clustered in this way, or here's why I think it's in this area, which is probably not going to have anything good on it, if I'm being honest, because it's all just rock and brush, and who knows how the landscape has changed since that these graffiti were written. But yeah, so yes, I've made sketches. I also took photographs, and I have permission to publish the photographs of the tablets.
Exciting,
so that's beautiful. And I again thank everyone in Greece for giving me a chance to do this. So there should be some photos in my thesis once it is done.
Oh, that's very exciting. Yes. Yeah. No, it's great that you've got permission, because sometimes you can look at things for scholarship, but they have to stay, you know, with the right stay with whatever institution is hosting those sources. So that is very kind of them. That's great to see. Yeah. Well, Anna, it has been so great chatting with you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, and the best of luck with the rest of your research.
Thanks so much for having me. I had a lot of fun.
So that is it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM. Grad Chat. Grad Chat.
Hey, this is Cleo, and I hope you folks will join me Tuesdays at 5 for my new show, All Tunes. From punk rock to folk, we got it all. Tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM. See you Tuesday.
Yo, Ellie.
Hey, Nate, what's up?
I'm on the radio.
What? Like right now?
Yeah, it's on a promo from Live Sessions.
Oh, yeah, CFRC Live Sessions, Thursdays at 11 a.m.
Listen to sexy bands play live on air and hear exclusive interview highlights.
Sounds awesome. Tune in on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Lit. Okay, peace out, dude.
See you Thursday.
The Kingston Canadian Film Festival returns this winter, running February 25th to March 1st in downtown Kingston. With close to 100 Canadian films, the Kingston Canadian Film Festival also hosts tons of comedy, live music, workshops, and special guest appearances. Highlights this season include casts from Letterkenny, Biff Naked, Sean Majumder, July Talk, and Mark Ford. Make sure to check out the opening night film Youngblood, a fresh remake of the original hockey cult classic. And get ready for the new Degrassi documentary with a live appearance from cast members Spike and Caitlin. The Kingston Canadian Film Festival, running February 25th to March 1st. Check out the lineup and get tickets by visiting kingcanfilmfest.com.
Today on Wings.
Realigning with the value of life, Indigenous perspectives. The difference is that nothing that was required for the sustaining of life was ever made a commodity.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
There's Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
In April 2015, Angela Miles of the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education hosted an evening of 10 women speaking on themes of gift, matriarchy, mothering, and Indigenous worldviews. Here is Sherry Mitchell's talk, introduced by Angela Miles.
Sherry was born and raised in the Penobscot Indian Reservation. She speaks and teaches around the world on Indigenous worldview and spiritual change. Sherry is the author of Sacred Instructions, Indigenous Wisdom for Living Spirit-Based Change. She's the founding director of the Land Peace Foundation, an organization dedicated to the global protection of Indigenous land and water rights and the Indigenous way of life. Sherry is also the visionary behind Healing the Wounds of Turtle Island, a global healing ceremony that has brought people together from all corners of the world. And very, very, very centrally points out the spiritual and the economic here. These things are inseparable. They've been separated and torn apart in a lying way in our society. They have to come together. And I think the kind of work that Sherry does that in a really exemplary way.
Kwe, Andeliwisi, Wanahamugwasit, Najiopunawipskik. Pasilda and Dildambayama Kawasus Nilbanawepskeg Nagakakagus Niltibayik Nalita Hazu and Dayan. My name is Wanahamugwasit, and the colonial name that I was given by requirement at birth was Sherry Mitchell, and I'm happy to be able to be here with you. I decided that I would talk about the things that are most important to me in regard to these issues that we're facing in regard to mothering and a new way of placing value in the world. Because I think that the problem with the market exchange is that we have placed all of our value on a market economy. We even define people who are single as being on the market. So even our most personal relationships are based in this kind of valuation system. And one of the problems is the fragmentation and commodification of ourselves. As women, we were the first commodity in this trade market. 3000 BCE, women were sold and traded for the purposes of marriage. And so our bodies became the first product. That led to slavery that led to the valuation of individual property rights, the taking of the land, all of these other things kind of spiraled out of that initial commodification of the body of the woman. And so we see the suppression of women's rights being in direct correlation to the desecration of Mother Earth. And so when we think about who we are, where we come from, where we belong, all of those things have to be evaluated in our discussions about these things, because it's critically important for us to have an understanding of where we've come from, how we got there, and where we need to go from here going forward, because mistakes are repeated when we're not aware of how they were created. And so I want to just tell you some stories. I want to tell you about one of our creation stories. In our tradition, I can only speak for my own tradition, which is a unique perspective. And it is not an indigenous perspective per se, in the way that there's a pan-indigenous worldview, though there are similarities. We all have distinct cultural beliefs. We all have distinct traditions. We all have distinct ways of being in relation to life, but there are core similarities that can be found across the globe in indigenous cultures. And I also, at some point, want to address the question about pride that this young woman over here, and I can say she's a young woman because I'm older than she is, about having pride in who we are as indigenous people. For me, like, who am I as a Skijinawe Apit, an Elbunwapskik? Who am I as a daughter of the Penobscot Nation? And so in our creation stories, there are two figures that make up the creator. The creator is not a single individual. And we look at the world from a balanced point of view. So we have Kichiniwesk and Ekjimundo. Kichiniwesk is a sacred feminine. Ekjimundo is the sacred masculine. And in this story, Ekjimundo is the void of all possibility. It's that collection of matter that's waiting for animation. And so Ekjimundo sits stable, waiting for the voice of Kichiniwesk to speak into him. And it is the voice of the sacred feminine speaking into that pool of matter that provides us with all possibilities, creating ripples, vibrations that create form. And then that form is animated and moves out into the world. And that's the dance between the sacred masculine and the sacred feminine. And so in our stories, when we talk about our creation and how that connects to our web of life, we don't have, 3 months to sit here together and talk about all of the stories. But what I can tell you is that that seed of life created through the dance of Kichiniwesk and Ekjimundo, when it was put into motion and that seed expanded, creating all life across our universe, that creates what we know as the web of life. And this web of life concept is not theoretical. It's not mythological. It's scientific. We all come from this great seed of life that exploded and expanded across the known universe. And so our teachings about web of life, what we call Pasilda and Ilnabamuk, looking at all things as our relatives, is based on this understanding of the creation of the universe, where we were all part of one seed of life. We're all comprised of this one collective of matter that is spread across the universe. In 1992 in Geneva, scientists, there should be an X on the floor.
Yeah, I know. You're on the edge.
I'm always on the edge. Yeah. So in 1992 in Geneva, scientists did an experiment called the twin photon experiment.
And in that experiment, they wanted to see the relationship between two photons that were once connected that are then separated, to see if there's a correlation between the two. So one was stimulated in one way to see if the other would respond. And they found out that it did. And then they wanted to see if there was a time lapse between the stimulation of one and the response in the other. And they found out that there was no time lapse, that it was instantaneous, that when one was stimulated, the other instantaneously responded. And so what they devised from this was the term quantum entanglement, right? And so this quantum physics term of quantum entanglement is tied to the indigenous understanding of the web of life. That we are not just connected in theoretical ways. It's not just when I have too much, you have too little. There's a real spiritual and energetic connection that takes place. And so a way to understand that is to think about phantom limb theory. Somebody has their leg amputated and they still get sensations in their foot. Their leg still itches, they can feel it. This is another scientific understanding of Web of Life teachings from the indigenous perspective. And so that understanding is based in these concepts of quantum entanglement that says that any matter that is once connected physically can never be disconnected energetically. For us, we take that a step further and say energetically and spiritually. So because we came from this one seed of life, we can never be disconnected energetically or spiritually from one another. And so when we see this mother whale carrying her baby around for 17 days, trying to communicate to us what we're doing to life, that's a message for us about quantum entanglement. When we look around the world and we recognize that anxiety and depression is impacting the majority of the population, that's a message to us about our connectivity. And the problem is that we have lost sight of the depth of our connectivity. The problem is that we don't understand that these Web of Life teachings are trying to explain to us these concepts of quantum entanglement. So when we're feeling extreme anxiety in our bodies and we can't identify the source, when we're feeling triggered by trauma, by depression, and there's no easy way for us to explain it, right? For some of us, we can easily connect our experience to our lived trauma. But what about those who had a childhood that was full of noodle salads and happy birthdays? What about those people who can't explain their trauma and connect it to their lived experience, but they're feeling it in their bodies anyway? A society tells them there's something wrong with you. You're flawed. You're broken. The truth is that something is right with them. Because what they're feeling in their bodies is the pain of that mother whale. What they're feeling in their bodies that they can't identify is the pain of the mother whose child washed up on the shore dead. That was all over the news from Syria. What they're feeling in their bodies is the immense loneliness of the last of a species who's about to go extinct. What they're feeling in their bodies is the deep grief of our tree families as their relatives are being cut down. And it's this disconnection that we have with life that causes us to respond in these frantic ways to try to fill the emptiness that we're feeling with more stuff, rather than reconnecting ourselves to life. So what I was taught was that we as women are the creators of life, that we have a sacred responsibility
that was gifted to us to bring life into this world from the other side. That our bodies actually contain a portal that connects this world with the other worlds. That we call forth that life, we bring it into our bodies, and we cultivate it in the waters of life below the space where our heartbeat can be heard. And in that heart-based space, we care for and we nourish the life that we've been given. That's our first ecosystem, is our mother's womb. Then we are born a second time into this world, and that umbilical connection that has sustained us through our gestation is transferred to the Earth Mother, and the Earth Mother sustains us for the remainder of our lives. And when we lose that connection to the Earth Mother, we lose our way. And so now we're dealing with millennia of that connection being purposely severed. We're dealing with millennia of the heart-based wisdom of the sacred feminine being denied. We're dealing with the implications of millennia of masculine action out into the world not being informed by the sacred voice of Kachiniwesk, who is the keeper of life. And as a result, we're creating a reality that is void of life. So we think about the things that we value in the society, and we value our role as consumers. We value youth. We value beauty, which means that we're not looking to our elders anymore, right? We're not looking to our elders for answers. We're not valuing the wisdom and the gift of old age. We're not valuing ourselves as intact human beings outside of a market valuation system. We're commodifying all aspects of who we are. And so we're seeing the evidence of that playing out on a global stage right now. And so what we call this time right now is the time of Giwalk. Giwalk is the cannibal giant. And Giwalk is the protector of the sacred feminine. Giwalk is the protector of Mother Earth. And so the story says that Giwalk lies asleep in the forest for ages and only awakens when he hears a specific cry of the Earth Mother that tells him that human beings are consuming faster than she can produce and harming her faster than she can heal. And when Giwalk awakens, he dances the people into this frenzied illusion of mass consumption until the species dances themselves off the planet so that the Earth Mother can renew herself. And in our stories, we're told that this is the fourth time we've been here, and we haven't figured it out yet. And so now we're here with another chance to change our course. But the only way for us to put Giwalk back to sleep is for us to wake up. And to realize that the lie that we have been fed, the original sin, in my opinion, this illusion of separation, is going to lead us to our extinction. We have to start recognizing that this belief in othering, not only within our species, the ways that we other ourselves and the ways that we separate ourselves, but also this othering from the natural world. So one of our other creation stories tells us that we were born or we entered this world when Gluskabe, the man from nothing, that void of potential, shot an arrow into the ash tree and split it open, and we came from its roots. We emerged from within its roots. And that doesn't tell us that the ash tree is our mother. That tells us that the ash tree is our kin, that we're made up of the same foundational elements as that ash tree. And today we still weave our baskets from the ash tree to remind us that we are woven together with all of the elements of life. And that the container that holds our life is the very elements of creation that we're tied to. And so when we forget those stories, when we forget the truth of what we know deep in our core about our relationship to life, we begin acting in a way that creates an imbalance that leads to the destruction of life. And so I wanted to talk about the realigning of life because we're talking about creating this new way of being in the world that to us is ancient. We call it Skijinawe Bamalsawagen. It's a way of being in relation with life that is harmoniously balanced. It's not an inherent right. It's a balancing of our rights with responsibilities. So the Earth Mother, what we call our first Lagudawagen, right? You can call it a treaty or a contract or an agreement. This Lagudawagen is entering into a kinship relationship. And our first Lagudawagen was with Mother Earth when we came here. First with the Creator that we would come here, then with Mother Earth when we came here. And what we agreed to was to stand in protection of all life so that we would have the right to be able to freely accept the gifts that Mother Earth gave us to sustain our lives. So we believe in a balancing, right? I also come from a trade culture. You know, we traded goods. The difference is that nothing that was required for the sustaining of life was ever made a commodity. Our bodies are not commodities. Mother Earth is not a commodity. Our food, our water, our air, none of those things are commodities that you can't commodify and you can't sell and you can't create any type of legitimate balanced trade where life is at stake. And so when we're talking about a mothering economy, when we're talking about a gifting economy, we're talking about being able to sustain the very elements of life. That means changing our entire valuation system from one that's based on profitability to one that's has life at the very top. The sacredness of life, the value of life. And so I wanted to share those stories with you just to ground our time together in a bit of history that science is now beginning to understand as being more than mythology, that there's deep wisdom in our ways of being. And we understand that our oral traditions are based on Kachiniwesk speaking into Ekchimundo and creating form. We understand that frequency and vibration create form, and that that form eventually creates the reality that we're living in. There's deep scientific truth in that. It's not a mythology. And so all of these things that we're talking about are rooted in deep truth. It's not some harebrained idea that somebody just came up with. It's a balanced way of being that is aligned with life. And so there's this incredible beauty in it. And I also want to speak to you. And one of the things that we found in our community is that the pride that you're talking about is found in what we call our mother tongue. Because our language contains all of the instructive and relational elements that guide our lives. Our languages have been existing in relationship with the places where we're from for tens of thousands of years. And so as we've begun to reclaim our languages and decolonize our languages from the flat, efficient manner that they've been pared down to,
to restore and breathe the life back into our languages. That as we're teaching our children those languages, they're learning to understand the depth of knowledge that we possess as Indigenous peoples. One of my friends tells a story about being a student, and there were most of the students from her community only spoke in their language, and the teachers shamed them because of the language barrier that existed between them and their English-speaking teachers. And that there was all of this feeling of inadequacy that was created in them. And when she was 19 years old, she went to her first ceremony. And when she went to that first ceremony and started to learn from those elders, she realized that everything that she really needed to know was contained within that language. She realized that her people had a complex understanding of deep science and mathematics, geology, astronomy, that there was all of this incredible depth of knowledge that she had been forcibly separated from through the intrusion of colonial education, and that reclaiming that Indigenous education through the mother tongue. There's a reason why it's called the mother tongue, because it connects us in relationship to the places where we're from. That created within our young people the pride in knowing who they are and where they come from. The pride in understanding what they carry. Because one of the dangers is this kind of new age notion in oneness. Because we believe that oneness equals sameness. And that couldn't be further from the truth. Because when we homogenize ourselves, we strip away our core values. And then we forget how to live in relationship to life. So when we start thinking about the fact that our ecosystems with Mother Earth, our relationship to those, give us all the information that we need in order to live healthy, whole lives, we start understanding that our human family also needs to have that same diversity. My friends in Maori territory have Maori school, right? I have friends who have Greek school. Reminding of those core values and insistence upon knowing those core values. We have immersion schools in our territory. We're going to be creating a Wabanaki school, which is an after-school program that teaches all of these things to our children. Right, there's all of these different cultural teachings that are taught in an extracurricular form of environment where the parents are taking responsibility for ensuring that the core values remain intact. And I think that's how we create pride, is by really making a point of ensuring that the core values of where you come from, the core values of your people, are instilled within the hearts of your children. And we do that by demonstrating that pride ourselves, right? We have to show them how to get there by showing them that we're on that path as well. You know, it's not just something that somebody else can give them. It has to rise up from within them, and we give that to them. So I think I'm just going to say that much for now. There's a lot more I could share with you, but there's a lot of other people that want to speak, and I want to honor their time. So I just will say to you, Kachi Williwan, thank you so much for having me, and Pasilda Andil Nabamuk, you know, I offer these words for all my relations. And there's one more thing that I wanted to say that I should have said at the beginning, and I ask that the ancestors of this land forgive me, but I want to recognize that we're standing on the original land of the Indigenous peoples of this place. And so one of my favorite quotes is from a Crow elder named Shis Crow that says, "The soil you see beneath your feet is not ordinary soil. It is the dust of the bones, the flesh, and the blood of my ancestors. The soil as it is my dead and my blood." And that's another thing that we need to remember, is that the ancestors of those who have lived in relationship with that land have more than a territorial relationship. They have a blood relationship with that place. And so I just want to honor the original peoples of this place, Mississaugas, Haudenosaunee, Ojibwe, Wendat,
Cree. There's a whole lot of indigenous peoples that came from this territory. And so I want to recognize and I want to honor them. And I ask you to do the same. Thank you.
Sherry Mitchell, author of the book Sacred Instructions, Indigenous Wisdom for Living Spirit-Based Change. She is also a lawyer. Find more on Wikipedia. Her first name ends in an I. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. Thank you to your local community radio stations, to Suzette Cullen, and to Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the new book, The Maternal Roots of the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
You are listening to CFRC Radio from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local